is Circe Olson Wessner, the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Taos, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, At Ease. Today I'm interviewing Kate Peck. She's a veteran and author, a thespian, a grant writer. She has her own consulting company. And she was recently on one of our collaborative programs called So You Want to Be a Writer. So I'm very pleased to talk with her via telephone today because, of course, we still are in the pandemic. And I just wanted to warn our listeners that there are dogs and cats and who knows what else that might doorbells. And so we are just going to go for it. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Circe. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Yeah. I'd like to see you in person sometime. So you've done so many things over your life. I just want to jump right in. Let's start with your military career. What branch of service were you in, and what was the time frame that you served?
I was in the Naval Reserve. I enlisted in 1988, at the same time applying for a commission, and received the commission. I was a yeoman third class, got my commission in 1990, I believe it was, and then served until 2001 as a public affairs officer in the Navy.
So, thinking back to that time, were there a lot of women in your MOS?
There was a moderate number. I would say perhaps a quarter. Our number was 1655. We were public affairs officers, and there were a number of women, but we were by no means anywhere near even being equal to. The majority was male, but there were a number of women, and we got to, because of what we did, male or female, we got to go to a lot of places that normally people don't get to go. Because we provided, they used my reserve unit more or less as consultants. They would call us up when they had a special need. And that included women, wherever we needed to go.
Well, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions and then jump into a third. There's going to be lots of questions today. I just have tons of them. So did you have a lot of good mentors, like esprit de corps? And what good lessons did you take with you from that time in the military?
I cannot tell you how much I value the mentors I had. There was one, my first commanding officer as an officer was Commander Stallings, and he taught me a lesson which basically changed my life. When I was a brand new ensign, he told me that there's two kinds of authority. There's the authority you wear on your collar, and there's the authority you earn. And the former is worth nothing without the latter. So that was a lesson I will carry with me forever. And I could list on and on. And, you know, sometimes my best mentors were among the enlisted, especially the chief petty officers. They know how I like to say the chief petty officers run the Navy, and they know how it works. So, yes, I had many wonderful mentors. Captain Quigley at Strategic Command, Commander Stallings, I was... For the most part, I was assigned to the Pentagon with the Navy Chief of Navy Information, and around there, I had wonderful mentors.
So
it was a great service.
So I have a question. To be a public in public affairs, did you have to have a degree in communication or journalism in college?
You had to have a related degree. And then I went to DINFO, so I went to the Department of Defense Information School. And that's where they tweak your skills to be specific for the military. I don't know that you absolutely had to have it in journalism, but it needed to be in a related field.
Okay, so what was yours?
My degree was an odd degree. It was a compound degree. My major was in speech communications, and I had more or less a double minor in journalism and psychology.
Well, it sounds like you had the right skill sets for the job.
They thought so, and I wasn't going to argue with them.
So, in 2021, which is this month just started. The museum is putting together a program looking at gender, religion, race, identity, culture, and ethnicity in the military and military families. And we're just in this beginning stage of putting the project together and feeling out what it's going to look like. But it makes me want to ask you a question. During your military service, did you face any particular challenges or gain rewards because of your gender?
You know, I remember when I went to DC Direct Commission Officer School, there was an instructor who tried to tell the women to always wear skirts and be feminine. I probably couldn't get away with that today. But I noticed over the course of my career that those who followed the advice did not do as well as those of us who were a little more ready to prepare ourselves mentally and to dress in the clothing appropriate where we could do whatever job was needed. So I didn't particularly face too much gender bias. I felt like my co-workers, my fellow officers, the enlisted that worked for me, treated me with respect. Although I will admit, and it happened fairly regularly, I knew when an enlisted person working for me forgot and called me sir, that probably was a good sign. That a mental switch had fixed with them that I was due the respect related to the authority I was given.
Interesting. So let me just follow up on that. Do you think that person who was counseling all the women to look feminine was doing it on purpose to make them fail? Or do you think that was genuinely a heartfelt advice that just wasn't very relevant anymore?
I think he believed it. I think he was a well-intentioned individual, but he had a deeply ingrained social bias. That women should be feminine, and also, you know, there probably was subconsciously a feeling of what our role would be in the jobs that we did. So I don't think he had any ill intent at all. I think, you know, I do trainings for nonprofits, and one of the things I talk about is that, you know, all of us tend to have some biases that are so deeply ingrained we're not even aware of them.
Right.
And I think that was the case with that gentleman. I don't think he intended anything ill at all. I think he believed what he said.
Okay. So that brings me to the thought, you know, you've been out a bit now. What changes have you seen in the military, maybe in your MOS or in the military in general, since you got out? So you got out when? In what year?
I got out in, well, actually, I got out in officially in January 2002.
Okay.
But because of some circumstances, I had submitted I had resigned my commission in 2001.
Okay.
Early in 2001.
So
changes since I got out, I don't have that much interaction with the military anymore, more with veterans groups than I do directly with the military. Although I will admit I've had a couple of eye-opening conversations with young men who were recently discharged from the military. And I think there actually may have been some backpedaling in trying to help those in the military be open-minded about people who are different. I don't know that that's pervasive, and I couldn't say that I've had extensive experience with that, but I have had a couple of conversations with recently discharged individuals, and I was a little surprised at some of the things they said.
So what do you mean by different?
Muslims. LGBTQ. People who may not fit into the pocket of what I hope is a small minority perceive as actually being American.
Wow. That is eye-opening. That is eye-opening. And we're trying to look at that picture in our project that I was describing earlier, looking at gender, religion, race, identity, culture, and ethnicity. And I'm sure there's many other things that will come up when we start delving in. Interesting. Well, so let's go on to when you got out. What did you do right after you retired? Is that when you decided you were going to be a writer?
Oh, I've been a writer forever.
Okay.
And actually, just to clarify, I'm not retired. I am former military.
Okay.
I hope this isn't awkward for you, but in 2001, when I was asked to reaffiliate with my old unit, and all the paperwork was done, I was ready to go, and I received the new Don't Ask, Don't Tell document, which was required by signature. And it was something that I could not in good faith sign. So I also felt like it was a constitutional violation.
Wow.
So at that time, I had to make a choice between signing that document or resigning my commission. And trying to live according to my conscience, I chose to resign my commission.
So for people who don't know, and I actually don't know what would be on that document, what kind of questions did it ask?
You know, I need to pull it out again. I did feel like it was specifically intended as a way to get around Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That is phrased in such a way that should a commanding officer realize that there is someone in their command who's LGBTQ, that they still had a basis on which to rid themselves of those personnel. Not directly as asking and telling, but by creating more or less an umbrella that potentially could be applied. I'd have to pull that document out.
Right.
And it's been a few years ago to remember specifically what was said, but I do know that once reading it, I could not in good faith find it.
Wow, what a hard choice. What a hard choice to so you had to give up
tough.
You had to you decided to leave a career that you loved but keep your soul in such a way.
That's exactly how it felt.
Yeah. Yes. Huh. So you got out and
and
I know you said you've been a writer forever because you know of your background, but what did you do immediately after you got out, and how was that transition?
Well, I had always been reserved, so and there was a reason for that. I would do periods of active duty, but I always had either a job or a business on the side, and I just stepped full-time into the consulting business once I left the military career, and have done that for quite some time. And also other forms of writing. My first career was as a journalist, starting in 1974. Writing has been my life forever.
Right. And I know you do grant writing, and you mentor people, and you do some consulting work. So what brought you to New Mexico? Because I know you're based here in New Mexico.
Well, at the time. Let me see. That was also in 2001. I was offered a job with a national Native American organization. That was a relatively short term job via a grant, which I accepted that position and came to New Mexico for what I thought was for a short term, and fell in love with New Mexico, and that's where I stayed.
A lot of veterans have that experience. They come here for one duty station, and that's it. They're forever lifers.
Yep. I remember my realtor at the time when I decided to buy a house, calling it the land of entrapment.
It's
an addictive state. It's a wonderful, wonderful place.
Yeah. Shh, don't tell people.
Okay.
So I know you said you haven't stayed much in touch with the active military or the reserves, but I know you're very involved with veterans and arts organizations. So what makes you want to stay connected to those military roots? In essence, you know, you're serving even after you've served, even after you left, and kind of an ethical, moral reason. So why stay connected with veterans?
You know, there is no experience quite like being in the military. I mean, just taking the oath of office. There are very few jobs in this world, I think, where you have to, if you raise your hand and take an oath, that's something of a philosophical and moral transformation. And I know for me that that oath never went away. And I think for most veterans, it feels like it never goes away. And I do feel a special bond with my brothers and sisters who have served in the military. And I don't think their stories and the family's stories are told in such a way that people who don't have the experience can understand. And as a writer, that's one of my passions, is to be able to tell those astounding stories in such a way that, that it not only moves the people who live it, but also the people who read about it, or who are, for a flash of a moment, able to comprehend what that service is like. I also believe that, that we don't realize to what extent the networking of veterans continues to affect our society.
Right.
Because it's not long back, I had a client tell me that they, when they needed something that needed to be done well and needed to be done quickly, they tended to hope to find a veteran because they consistently knew that that was a population that, that they could rely on to do things well and do them quickly.
Well, you know, it's interesting. So I'm glad you mentioned the family too. And I have the same, I had the same experience. The other day I wanted to buy something. Somebody was on Facebook and they said, hey, I have this, you know, it was something I wanted to get for the museum. And it was a keepsake plate from Germany. And I said, ooh, he said, just send, you know, somebody pay the postage and I will, and I'll send it to you. So I wrote him a check. You know, he told me how much the postage was. I wrote him a check, sent it off to a complete stranger. I said, he's a brat. I can trust him. My husband's like, who's this person that you just wrote this check to? I said, oh, I don't know. So hey, I am not an easy mark, okay? I knew that I could track him down. But it was just like, he's a brat. I believe him. You know, somebody sent us a yearbook to scan and then expected us to send it back. And we did, because why? It's a code, just like you said with the veterans. You know, there's like this military family, military code of honor.
Well, you know, with your shipmates or your fellow soldiers or your fellow Marines or your fellow airmen, you're in a situation where at any one time, your life may depend on being able to rely on them.
Right.
But it goes both ways.
Right.
And I think that that's something that across the board profoundly affects people, and it makes being reliable, being conscientious, something essential. And I think that carries on out into civilian life. You know, I guess I should have mentioned earlier that one of the things I found fulfilling since leaving the Naval Reserve is I've been a volunteer firefighter for many years. And you find that same type of camaraderie in the fire service.
Right. And you have to depend on people there, too, to make snap decisions.
Exactly.
So I feel like I've known you forever. We have some mutual friends, and I know we've attended some events together. But I think that I first remember really connecting with you at one of the veterans and military and the arts roundtables at the Veterans Memorial. Sorry, my phone is beeping. Hang on one sec.
Sure.
the beauty of phone interviews. So I think we reconnected at one of the Veterans and Military and the Arts Roundtable at the Albuquerque Veterans Memorial. You know, we were representing veteran in arts organizations. I was representing the museum. I think you were there representing the Nat Gold Players. Is that right? Or
that's correct. Yes.
So tell us a little bit about the Nat Gold Players, and then also, you know, the theater where you perform. What do you guys do?
Nat Gold Players has been around in Las Vegas, New Mexico for at least 15 years. We've had a little trouble tracking down the history of the beginning. And we do our mission is to entertain, educate, and inspire the community. Mm-hmm. Using performing arts. Mm-hmm. And that's what we try to do. And we do various types of shows, everything from, we did a couple of the Nonsense productions, which draws a lot of people and a lot of laughs. Everything from, I know as part of our effort to serve veterans, we put together a show called New Mexico Heroes, and we solicited short pieces from, for, by, and about veterans from anywhere in the state that wanted to submit. And we ended up with monologues, poetry, a short play that we used to just the piece to tie everything together, some incredible music. We try to do shows to serve the community, sometimes to entertain, sometimes to inspire, sometimes to educate. And in Las Vegas, I don't think a lot of people realize the level of performing arts talent that's here. Largely because the arts have been a long-standing tradition in the area. As a matter of fact, Las Vegas has a theater tradition that goes back to 1835 with Spanish language theater. And then in the late 1800s and early 1900s, it was pretty much a performance center for the Southwest. So we have a lot to live up to. As Nat Gold Players, we do our best. I'm very, very proud of the company. We've been a homeless theater for forever. Not quite as long as I've been a writer, but forever. And we recently, we have a totally portable theater. We can set up whatever venue we can obtain to do a show. With light, sound, seating, the whole thing. But we recently, we've had a partnership with the Masonic Lodge for a few years, doing a haunted house as a fundraiser. Which led to when the ground floor of their historic building came open, we just recently moved in, and we're finally going to be able to create our theater, our home. Very pleased about that, and also pleased with being able to have an opportunity to help preserve an important historic building.
Well, people don't realize, you know, first of all, people, when you hear Las Vegas, you immediately think of the Nevada Las Vegas, but they don't realize that Las Vegas, New Mexico is a beautiful, lots of Victorian houses. It's a beautiful town, and it has a really fine private school there, the Armand Hammer World College. And
United World. Yes.
Yeah.
It's internationally respected. Most of the students who graduate from there end up at Ivy League institutions. And it's international. If I recall, half the student body, it's one of a whole series of world colleges around the world. And half the student population is from the host nation and half is from wherever.
Right.
So this little town in New Mexico has quite an opportunity to experience international cultures.
Wow, that's cool. That's cool. My husband went to a world college when he was young in England. Hey, so we want to talk about your latest book. That was the purpose of this interview. And I know you said this before on our collaborative writers workshop the other day, but tell our listeners now that a little bit about the incident that sparked the book Broken. That happened at the military roundtable we were at. So what happened?
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
Well, to understand the story, I think the listeners need to know that Broken is about a veteran with PTSD. And it's also about another character who suffers suffers from PTSD from an experience when she was young.
Okay.
So to know that, that I was very motivated to write something where people could see PTSD from the inside out, mm-hmm. to better understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing, the incident that you mentioned that motivated me, it took me a couple years to do it, but I knew I had to write that book.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I remember there was a young man, if I recall correctly, he was a recently discharged Marine.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of those sessions, he stood up and was starting to tell his story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I remember him saying the phrase that you want to help vets, but you want it to be pretty, and it's not always pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him starting to tell his story, and he lost it.
Mm-hmm.
Here was a 6-foot-plus, strapping, healthy, young, recently discharged Marine, bawling, and he couldn't stop.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw, looked around and saw the shock, mm-hmm. across the room, and mm-hmm. I was quite far from him, and I was waiting for somebody there nearby to help him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And eventually walked across the room and did the only thing I could do. I just held the young man, and well, he cried.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a whole lot you can do at times like that.
Yeah.
But I also knew not only his need to have that story out, but also to help those who want to help and don't have a clue about the depth of the experience or the level of the pain. So that made me motivated to write. I do a presentation called Truth in Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes through fictional characters, you're able to tell truth that you can't express any other way.
Right.
And that's what I have tried to do with Broken.
Well, and I want to continue with Broken, but going back to that moment, I was there. I was even further across the room than you were. And I think we were probably one of only a handful of military-connected people in the room. Everybody else was mostly the arts. And I think everybody was frozen with what do we do, and we don't know what to do. And you were over there, and you were already, and there's nothing I can do. I'm a spouse. I don't know. I haven't been there. So I was glad when you got up as a veteran and went to talk, because, and not to talk, but just to be with him, because, you know, you do feel helpless. You don't know if you go over there, are you going to embarrass him? You don't know. You can't say, I know how you feel, you know? So I'm glad that you did go, and I'm glad you're writing a book to have people who may not know understand a little bit about PTSD. And you're showing PTSD from different perspectives of PTSD, too.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, I think...
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I think one of the reasons we serve in the military is to try to, as much as possible, deal with the issues, deal with those pieces of life that are raw. I don't know what else to call it.
Mm-hmm.
They're raw.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do our job right, there are a lot of people who are wide-eyed and don't know what to do when that rawness becomes real.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I guess in a way, the reaction of those who are involved with the arts was a testament to the success of that young man and so many others serving in the military,
mm-hmm.
being able to help American citizens live productive lives with as little rawness as possible.
Right, right. So, you know, I was on Amazon looking at Broken, and it was categorized in LGBTQ and Western genres, but it's so much more than that, so I was kind of interested in knowing, I guess those were the two you could pick to categorize it in. There's probably not, is that the best categories that they had for it? Are there categories on PTSD, or...
Not specifically, and since it's fiction,
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't go into self-help or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'm not exactly sure. I think my publisher has some say in what categories to pick.
Uh-huh.
And I probably, if I were picking, would include general fiction. And this is one of the little shell game that you play in the publishing industry. Part of selecting categories, I think, is selecting ones where it's likely to sell well, so that you can, you know, Broken has, I think it was over 3 weeks, was in the categorical bestseller lists for LGBTQ and Western. So sometimes choosing the categories is a strategic thing to help the book do better.
Well, there were 57 reviews, and it was like it was more than 4 stars. It was like 4.5, but it was like more like 4.75, if you can color a star. So, I mean, it got great reviews and some very good comments as well. So who did you write the book for? I mean, we talked about Western genre and LGBTQ. Who did you write this book for? And do you want to tell a little about the storyline while you're at it, or will that give it away?
I'll try to do it without any spoilers.
Okay.
But it's about a Navy captain, career officer, who is, and this is in the first couple of chapters, who loses a foot as a result of an improvised device. And in the course of everything, she loses her career, she loses her foot, it affects her personal life. Basically, she's broken. A very strong person who's lived a successful life and loses everything. And goes back to the only thing she has left, really, which is the family ranch she grew up on. And it is there, the support of family, also reconnecting with her childhood friend, who also suffers from PTSD. And I guess one of the theme lines throughout the book is there's a piece about that she to repair broken crockery with gold. And it makes it even more beautiful than it was before it was broken. So the book is largely about being able to deal with the brokenness and find your gold. And as an aside for you, I have a little bit of a follow. I like to write contemporary Westerns because I know that life, it's a wonderful life. I actually have a pretty good following of straight and gay that like to read my stories set in contemporary West. So that's why it was set where it was. And I wrote the book for several categories of people. First and foremost, and I say the same thing about theater, even if you have a message in what you're writing when it comes to fiction and plays and screenplays, it has to be entertaining. So the biggest group would probably be just people who want to read a good book, who want to read a good story, who want to get in touch with characters that they can appreciate, that they can value. Second group is a bigger group, because I think it's valuable for lots of people to be able, within the safety of fiction, to be able to look at a raw side of life, to be able to understand what that's like to go through, and maybe even to dig within themselves a little bit to see how they could react or how they can support others who are dealing with trauma. And beyond that, you know, you create, it's a little bit like giving birth when you write a book. Because you can help raise it, you can help create it, but when it gets out there, it's going to have a life of its own.
Right.
That you may or may not have any control over. So these are the audiences that I would have written for. One of the big ones is those who love those who suffer from PTSD and don't know how to help. So that's one of the audiences I wanted to write for. Also, like, wanted for people who do suffer from PTSD to know that they're not alone. That there are others out there to root for them.
So you said
I don't know what other audience it may be. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. You know, so you said it in the West. Did you grow up on a ranch? I mean, there's a lot of ranch.
Yes.
And, okay, so tell where did you?
I grew up on a ranch.
Where?
I grew up on a ranch in the Texas Panhandle.
Ah. Okay.
And still live a rural life and love it. There's nothing like it. Of course, I've only got one horse and 2.33 acres instead of the many acres we had to have a ranch operation.
Right.
But I still love the life.
Well, cool. So I think we've actually touched upon the message you want people to take away from the book. And I wanted to say, you know, it's funny, like in the last week or two, I've heard so many references to this gold and this broken pottery and this gold. It's a Japanese concept, I think. And then you mention it in your book, and then one of the people who wrote a compliment about your book mentioned it, and I think it's I think it's Japanese, but there's actually kits you can buy to fix something that's broken, you know, on these online shopping things. So it's just like, that's amazing, and it is prettier. I dropped the antique teapot that my great-grandmother had. I mean, it was like a catastrophe.
Oh.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking about doing some sort of a mosaic with it and maybe some gold. But, yeah.
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 And I think it's also valuable for people to live a life where they risk being broken.
Yeah.
I kind of feel for people who never have an opportunity to see what they're made of.
Sometimes life
throws it at you without you making a choice.
Right. Well, look at this pandemic. You know.
Yes. Exactly.
400,000 people never expected that they would be dead within weeks of something, you know, getting sick. So I mean, it is we, maybe your message for your people are that we put ourselves out there, you know, we find the beauty in the day to day.
I want to tell a story, but I have to be careful how I do it.
Okay.
Because we had some months back, my fire department had to help transport a patient with COVID, who was at the point needing hospitalization. And the individual showed as great a courage as I've ever seen. Because that person was far more concerned with our safety than theirs.
Wow.
And despite being horrifically sick, found the strength to walk to the ambulance so that we didn't have to touch the individual. And that's daily courage. I wonder how much of that is out there. I wonder how much, you know, extreme situations bring out, I think more often the best in people. It can also bring out the worst in people, but I think sometimes it brings out the best in people.
Yeah.
And I'd love to know other stories like that.
Yeah.
How people have faced this with courage.
Well, my next question to you is going to be what's next for you, but maybe what's next for you is grace under pressure or safety. Actually, that's the name of our new project, so you can't have that one. But maybe that's your next project. Remarkable stories in horrific circumstances or something.
Yeah. That's not a bad idea. What I'm working on now is I have a screenplay that's won a couple of pretty major awards. And I'm in the process of doing a rewrite on that, and have an excellent individual who's helping me with do you know what a beta reader is?
Is that somebody who just reads the rough draft and gives you feedback?
Yes, basically. So I'm getting incredible input in working on a rewrite, and I'm excited because there has been some interest expressed in it. And the story behind that is it's set in Mora, New Mexico. And it's largely a celebration of the wonderful culture that you find in these old communities, in these traditional communities. That's what I'm working on at the moment, is a rewrite on that screenplay.
Well, that's really cool. That sounds exciting. So is there anything I should have asked you but I didn't?
No, not that I can think of. You've obviously thought this through very well.
Well, I like to be prepared.
I can't think of anything at the moment. You've actually triggered some thoughts for me. So,
good.
I appreciate that.
So let's wrap it up then. But where can our listeners learn more about your work? What are your websites, or where can we find out more about you?
You can see all my books on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
If you just enter Kate, and it's spelled K-A-Y-T,
mm-hmm.
Peck, P-E-C-K,
mm-hmm.
The books will pop up. You
mm-hmm.
can also go to my publisher's website at sapphirebooks.com. I believe on the website all you can get is the electronic ebooks.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon, you can order either. I have my own publishing website at caketech.com.
Okay.
And kind of have that open because people get requests for autographed books. So if you want an autographed book, probably best to go to my website and order through that.
Okay.
And if you want to know about my consulting business, it's at flyingpigsconsulting.com.
So I'll put the links to as many of the things that I have underneath this podcast in the notes. And so people can, if they're interested, click on the links and get to you that way. I just don't do Twitter and Instagram and all that because I'm not really good at those links. So unless you provide me a link like that. Yeah. Excellent. This was a very quick almost hour-long conversation, and I appreciate your taking the time. So I think that we have a good start. I hope people go out and check out Broken and any of your other books. Give some of your titles for some of your other books really quick so they can look for you.
On the contemporary westerns, it's Good Water,
mm-hmm.
Prairie Fire,
mm-hmm.
and then The Ladies' Room.
Okay.
And then I have a trilogy,
mm-hmm.
and Broken, we may talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
I have a magical realism trilogy that starts with Kiva and the Mosque,
mm-hmm.
And goes to The Pyramid and the Painting, and finally ends with The Past and the Present.
Oh, cool. Well, good. So they can look for those on Amazon for sure, and also on your website. So I wanted to thank you a lot today, Kate, for joining us, and I wanted to let our listeners know, as usual, that the museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brats Seal and Military Brats Registry. And it's been a wonderful talk with Kate Peck. Check out her stuff on Amazon, on her website, and if they need a good and excellent grant writer, Kate's the person. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you, Cersei. I appreciate this very, very much.